for schools, educators, students and educational developments. Dublin City FM.
Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I'm Barry Hennessy. Sean Delaney is off this week. Coming up in this week's programme.
From the 1980s, I suppose, and into the 90s and so on, trade unionism and what it stands for and what it represents, indeed, has been questioned.
I'll be talking to the author of a major centenary history of the country's largest post-primary teachers' union, the ASTI. Don't forget, if you've any comments or suggestions for the programme, you can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. If you've missed a programme and you'd like to catch up, you'll find podcasts of all the Inside Education archive on our website, insideed.com. Our podcasts are also available on iTunes, and if that's not enough new media for you, you can even follow us on Twitter at InsideEd. Well, first this week, as ever, a look at the major developments in education over the past 7 days, and news of the impending cabinet reshuffle has set tongues wagging across the country this week, and the education sector is no exception. The Taoiseach Brian Cowan seems certain to embark on a restructuring of government departments, with widespread suggestions that the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment will be broken up. The Teachers Union of Ireland this week called for a new Department of Education and Training that would bring the state training agency FOSS under the control of the Department of Education for the first time. The TUI has also joined the other post-primary union, the ASTI, in a major ramping up of the existing work to rule in schools, which will see teachers banned from taking up vacant posts of responsibility from next week. Annette Dolan, Deputy General Secretary of the TUI, has been filling us in on the implications of this move, but I first asked her to explain the union's call for a Department of Education and Training.
Well, Barry, first of all, TUI called for the establishment of a Department of Education and Training over 12 months ago. We believe that the opportunity is now there for the Taoiseach with these impending reshuffle of government ministers to do so. As you'll be aware, there are almost 450,000 persons now unemployed. There needs to be a coordinated and effective policy to upskill those individuals. Training at the moment comes under the remit of Enterprise, Trade and Employment. Department of Education and Science and Social and Family Affairs are integrally involved. So it's very fragmented. We are of the view that the whole issue of training and upskilling needs to come under the single, there needs to be a single umbrella department with that responsibility, and we are of the view that that should come under a Department of Education, Science and Training.
So what existing bodies would end up coming under the aegis of the Department of Education and Science? Would FOSS be among them, for example?
Yes, it would, yes. We just believe that if we are to effectively tackle the current unemployment crisis, that there needs to be coordination in terms of upskilling. Like, for example, there is no comprehensive adult guidance service in the country. There's a guidance service in FOSS, there's a guidance service in the VECs, there's guidance services in other bodies. But when somebody is made unemployed or made redundant, they should be able to go to a single service so that they get all of the options that are out there and are not diversified into FOSS or into various courses in other places, depending on the individual they go to, so that we are of the view that a comprehensive adult guidance service is important.
Annette, we better move on to the other major news of the week involving the post-primary union so far and potentially the INTO, if press reports are correct, and that is the new directive now with regard to posts of responsibility in schools. What exactly is going to change as of the 8th of March?
Well, as you know, the teacher unions have been engaged in work-to-rule type actions as part of a public sector wide campaign against pay cuts and pension levies. So as part of the campaign, the Teachers Union of Ireland, in conjunction with the ASTI, decided to escalate our directive on post responsibilities. So with effect from the 8th of March, our members will be directed not to engage in reviews of post responsibility or to change the duties of existing postholders to fill vacancies caused by the moratorium. What's happening at the moment, if somebody retires, they have an assistant principal post responsibility, for example, looking after the examinations or maybe having a year head position. That position currently is not filled. Now, up until now, we have permitted schools to reshuffle duties, but from the 8th of March, because of a government decision, which is having a dramatic effect on schools, in some schools, 3 and 4 and 5 assistant principal posts lie vacant. I came across one school in Galway the other day where there are six assistant principal posts vacant. It's a government decision that is having a dramatic effect on pupils' lives and on a daily basis. And we ask that this moratorium be lifted.
But surely the negative effects of this particular directive now, which in essence makes it impossible for any changes to take place internally in schools where a post of responsibility becomes vacant, surely those will be felt disproportionately by students and also by rank and file teachers, and not as such by the government against whom this campaign is surely directed.
But this is a government decision, and the effect of that moratorium is a lot wider than that. Like, if you look at what is happening in the wider sphere within education, there are currently 8 education officer posts within the VECs that are now vacant, from Wexford to Mayo to Kerry, Leitrim, and in Dublin itself. These are adult education officer posts. Within the VECs, within a whole county, looking at the development of adult education, looking at how to upskill and retrain adults who've become unemployed, and those posts are vacant. So the effects that of the moratorium is being felt in schools and in colleges and in the wider population. Not because of the actions of teachers, but because of the imposition of a moratorium, which is totally unfair and unjust.
Annette Dolan from the Teachers Union of Ireland there. You're tuned to Inside Education on Dublin City FM with Barry Hennessy. Well now, from lively and often angry national conventions to head office infighting to ploughing a lonely furrow outside the fold of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, the recent history of the country's largest second-level teachers union has seldom been far from the headlines. The ASTI is currently marking its centenary year. Representing 18,000 teachers in 56 branches, it's now once again a member of ICTU, and its current campaign against pay cuts and the moratorium on promotions in schools is being closely coordinated with both the TUI and the primary union, the INTO. Unlikely Radicals is the title of a major new history of the association, written by Dr. John Cunningham of the History Department of NUI Galway. The book charts the progress of a union that started out fighting for basic employment rights and decent pay for the small number of lay teachers in a profession dominated by priests and other religious. It details the relationship between the future Archbishop of Dublin, John Charles McQuaid, a dominant figure in Catholic school management, and the union's first full-time General Secretary, T.J. Burke. All in all, it's both a comprehensive history and a very accessible read. Well, I travelled to Galway this weekend to talk to John Cunningham about the life and times of a union that he spent some 3 years researching. For this programme, we focus on the period from the 1960s onwards, a time of major change both in education and Irish society. We begin by looking at the ASTI's pay campaign of the 1960s, when the union was implacably opposed to pay parity between primary and secondary teachers. I first put it to John Cunningham that in opposing the modest increase primary teachers stood to secure, the ASTI, far from being radical, appeared positively elitist in character.
Yeah, I think that that's a charge that could be made stand. The way things had evolved, most teachers and the ASTI couldn't even conceive of a situation where they had actual authority in schools, and they became determined to hold on to the advantage which they enjoyed over other teachers, and which they would have justified by saying that they were graduates. Primary teachers weren't at that particular time. And they would have argued also that the pedagogical skills which were required to do their job were greater. Now, that's a point which primary school teachers would have disputed. But certainly, As you get into the 1960s and this important developments, of course, in the system in the 1960s, which lead to a great growth. The profession had grown modestly, I suppose, in the period between the early 1920s and the early 1960s, but there was a considerable and rapid growth in response to a number of reforms, in particular the O'Malley reforms in the second part of the decade, free education and so on. So again, you have an influx of young people, young graduates, into a profession.
But again, on that note, for example, there was considerable scepticism voiced from within the ranks of the ASTI as to the need for free secondary education, was there not? Again, there were voices, influential voices perhaps within the union, mm-hmm. which came out as being remarkably conservative when presented with this unique possibility to expand education provision to children. People suggesting, for example, that they knew of no case where anybody had been not granted a secondary school place because of financial problems alone, which you, in one of your conclusions, say doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
Oh, certainly the experience of free education combined with school buses and so on was that there was an enormous and rapid increase in participation. But it wasn't just the ASTI, in fairness, that didn't see this coming. I don't think Donna O'Malley even saw this coming, in a sense. And certainly the basis on which the reforms were accepted at the time was that there wouldn't be this enormous increase in resources required, that it would be a gradual thing, which it wasn't, as we now know. Yes.
But by trying to defend, going back to the pay issue, the pay differential, which of course, needless to say, was the diametric opposite of what the INTO, another similarly influential union, would have wanted. It led to a very ugly situation by the end of the 1960s, allegations of betrayal on all fronts, agreements broken or not respected by government. And it strikes one that this is the start, is it not, of a process which has continued over time, whereby the ASGI has something of a knack of finding itself on the wrong side of public opinion.
Well, I suppose there were very particular circumstances in the late 1960s. You had this profession which had, and this association, the ASTI, had grown rapidly with young people, many of them radicalised in the context of the late 1960s campus, if you like. And you had a kind of a leadership of people who were perhaps graduates of the 1940s. So you had a kind of a conservative policy on the one hand and a radical approach which was driven by the younger people, if you like. So this was the context in which you had these bitter disputes of the early of the late 1960s and early 1970s. A traditional position of defending the salary differential, and I suppose, and at the same time, the methods of the late 1960s. Because I suppose, if you look outside education altogether, that's a period of considerable radicalism and militancy within the trade union movement, which was seen to have produced results in other contexts,
and in the context of the particularly charged industrial relations environment, at least within teaching of 1969, 1970, etc., significant evidence of real discord, disharmony between the younger members of the union and the union leadership.
That's
but
right. Yeah.
Is that almost an inevitability within trade unions?
I suppose what was different to that particular point was the weight of the membership, of the younger membership, in terms of the great expansion of the profession meant that the younger people had had an enormous weight within the structures, within branches and so on at that particular moment. And I suppose initially there was some success as a result of the 1969 strike. It didn't satisfy many of the younger people and so on, but it also placed the ASTI not just in opposition to the government, but in opposition to larger unions like the INTO, and as a result of pressure from primary teachers, indeed the government and other factors, including costs, the government pulled back from the agreement that settled the 1969 dispute.
John, I suppose it's inevitable in trade unionism that there are going to be disputes from time to time. What changes, I suppose, is the public response to those disputes. Now, you document very well in the book how, in the case of, we'll say, the major 1969 strike, which is probably the single most prolonged strike in the history of the association, there was considerable, well, there was very significant support from students for their teachers, and there were demonstrations of support which were very well marshalled and well behaved. By the time the prolonged pay dispute of 1999 onwards came about, young people had found a rather different voice, and teachers found themselves facing opposition from a quarter that they hadn't previously experienced.
Mm-hmm. That's true, and I suppose historically, during a number of disputes, if we go back to the 1920, when the teachers struck against Catholic employers, the 1960s, again in the mid-1980s, there were indications of support from students and sometimes parents for secondary teachers in dispute. I suppose for a rather different reaction in the early 2000s, you have to take into account changes in the general climate from the 1980s, I suppose, and into the 90s and so on. Trade unionism and what it stands for and what it represents, indeed, has been questioned. Teachers found themselves locked into agreements which limited their increases each year and demanded productivity in exchange for even limited agreements, for even limited increases. At the same time, teachers were looking at people in areas like IT and finance and so on, and could see that people were getting enormous salaries at quite young ages. Teachers themselves felt they were facing quite a considerable number of challenges placed by society generally and what students needed to know, but also some of the social challenges, consequences of the other social changes. So I suppose that was the context of the grievance, which grew during the 1990s within teaching generally, and not just within the and even within the public sector more generally.
Well, the period from 1999 to 2002, give or take,
yes,
is well remembered, obviously, and it is a period during which the ASTI found itself in conflict, not just with, I suppose, those whom it might expect to come into conflict with at such a time, the Department of Education, sections of the media, etc., but of course with even bodies which would be regarded as fraternal unions, pulling out of ICTU and the rest of it.
Yes.
And it's often suggested that the union at that time came under the control of something of a clique which was unrepresentative in some ways of the broader body of teachers. Now, is that an accurate way of portraying it?
Well, it's very difficult at this space from the historian's point of view to judge a question like that. But I suppose there's no doubt that the arguments of the anti-partnership element within the association found an echo within the broader association, and in a number of ballots at conferences, but also ballots of the general membership, that their arguments won support.
But when one looks, for example, at the influence of Bernardino O'Sullivan, who was the president who came into office in 1999 and
yes,
became very quickly one of the most recognised teachers' unions in many, many years, you know, you'll always meet plenty of teachers who will say that they never felt that Bernardino Sullivan represented them. And yet, yeah. and yet you will argue, I suppose, accurately from the historical perspective, that the opinions of Bernardino and those who agreed with her carried the day in the Union at that time. But is it more a case of those who shouted loudest being the only audible voices and the membership following blindly along, or can we actually assess the extent to which the membership actually did wholeheartedly agree with the more radical voices that were being heard at that time?
I'm not sure if it's wholehearted agreement, and I suppose, generally speaking, teachers are educated, they're graduates and so on, so they're rational people, so they were swayed by particular the arguments being made at that particular moment by the group with, you know, with which you identify, you know, that with which Bernardino Sullivan would have been identified, that those seemed to match what people were actually the experience, I presume, of people at that particular time. So it reflected an outlook among teachers, presumably at that time.
But ultimately, the whole adventure, yeah. the 30% pay demand, yeah. mm. the withdrawal from ICTU, the level of the ASDI's conflict, the going it alone,
yeah.
very much in the 2000-2001 school year, it's an adventure that ultimately ended in failure, is it not?
I suppose from interviewing people, that would also have been disputed as to whether it was a failure. Certainly, you couldn't say that there was a considered strategy, that there was a tendency to react to events in the way that the withdrawal from Congress and some of the other decisions were taken. They weren't probably strategically very sensible at the particular time. But I suppose those involved would argue that the level at which of the benchmarking award for all teachers was certainly affected by the fact, by the action that had been taken by the ASD. Otherwise, others would argue that it didn't make any difference. But certainly, that argument could be made, and with regard to the allowances for supervision and so on as well, that those levels were pushed up by the need to satisfy people in those years.
Except that ultimately it was yeah. Joe O'Toole's famous ATM machine, which was so reviled of ASDI spokespeople at that
yeah,
time,
yeah.
that turned out that in time delivered the goods, which, you know, to a certain extent must be regarded
yeah.
as something of a rebuke
yeah.
for the ASDI leadership.
Well, as I said, those benefits have all been withdrawn, I suppose, in the last year or so. That money is all gone now in the number of decisions that were taken. And it's probably, I don't want to be put into a position of judging, if you like. All I would do in relation to this dispute is to put the arguments that would be made, and indeed that were made at the time, and indeed the judgments that people would still hold. For many people in the ASTI, it was a kind of a futile adventure and a cause of rancour. And for others would argue that there were some benefits in the form of increasing the amount that came out of Joe O'Toole's ATM when it came to it's difficult to be certain one way or the other without sight of some of the discussions in the benchmarking body, for example.
Well, we talk about the arguments of that time, and of
yes.
course, it wasn't only in the public arena with regard to the government and the media and other unions that there were arguments at that time, but also it was a time of significant internal turmoil within the ASTI, with all sorts of allegations toing and froing with regard to allegations with regard to abuse of staff in the organisation by elected officials,
mm-hmm.
With a very public dispute involving the then General Secretary Charlie Lennon, who
yes.
ended up leaving his post as General Secretary after well in excess of 10 years. Now, when the work of a historian mm-hmm. comes into contact with matters which are not only very recent, but also very contentious and indeed legal, was it a difficult task for you to try to go through the files of that time, to research them adequately and to come up with any kind of adequate conclusions?
Yeah, I suppose a historian leaves, its, generally speaking, is leaving his or her comfort zone when you begin to engage with contemporary issues. But it was necessary in the context of a centenary history to engage with those issues. I think I would have engaged them with them in a different way to the way, and treated them differently to the way I would have treated the 1969 dispute, or even the whole issues that emerged in the 1980s, because I suppose what I would have tried to do is to fairly represent the arguments on either side, insofar as this was possible, and leave the reader essentially to draw conclusions based on the evidence, which I do my best to summarize there. Yeah.
Was there any reluctance on the part of your interlocutors within the ASTI to go into the matters of that time?
Oh, far from it. People were extremely keen to communicate their particular points of view in relation to that. And generally speaking, with regard to the process itself, I had tremendous cooperation from all levels in the association, whether at the head office level I had access to all sorts of to any document that was there. Anybody I approached for an interview, there was nobody refused an interview, nobody refused to answer a question or whatever. People were very upfront, people were very helpful, and so on throughout the process.
Dr. John Cunningham of NUI Galway speaking to me in Galway this weekend. Now, the book Unlikely Radicals, Irish Post-Primary Teachers and the ASTI 1909-2009 is published by Cork University Press. And our thanks too to the management and staff of the Merrick Hotel in Galway for allowing us to record our interview there. Well, that's it from Inside Education for this week. Don't forget that podcasts of all of our programmes are available on our website, insideed.com, where you'll also find useful links and references to the topics we've covered. You can also download our podcast from iTunes. We're back next Sunday at 7:30 PM here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I do hope you'll join us then. For now though, it's Barry Hennessy saying thank you for tuning our way, and stand by for Up and Down with the best in urban sounds. Good night.